Welcome to the KSTE Farm Hour. Here's KSTE's Farmer Fred, Fred Hoffman.
California's new governor outlined his plans for the future of California, and Gavin Newsom couldn't have been clearer.
I do not support the water fix as currently configured, meaning I do not support the Twin Tunnels.
And the governor made a big change in the leadership of the Department of Water Resources, a change in personnel that pleases many Central Valley growers. We have the details. There's new outbreaks of the deadly chicken illness, virulent Newcastle disease in California. We'll tell you where. Details about a new substitute for soil fumigation. It's called biosolarization, and its researchers recently won an achievement award from California's Department of Pesticide Regulation. All that and a lot more on this week's KSTE Farm Hour. Let's get started. When Governor Jerry Brown left office in January, there were still two big unfinished projects: a high-speed rail system that would take commuters from Los Angeles to San Jose, and the more controversial Delta Tunnels project, also known as California Water Fix, that would convey Sacramento River water from Cortland to the pumping stations in Tracy via two giant tunnels, upending the lives of residents and farmers in the Delta, with much of that water headed towards Southern California, as well as Central and Southern San Joaquin Valley farmers. What everyone wanted to know, what would the new governor, Gavin Newsom, do about these projects? Well, he didn't waste much time. He addressed both those issues at his State of the State address in Sacramento last week. And perhaps no truer words were spoken when he said this:
"You may not be clapping at the end of this, so sit down."
And Governor Newsom, addressing the state legislators, dove right in. Here's what he had to say about the high-speed rail project.
"But let's be real. The current project, as planned, would cost too much and respectfully take too long. There's been too little oversight and not enough transparency. Right now, there simply isn't a path to get from Sacramento to San Diego, let alone from, you know, San Francisco to LA. I wish there were. However, we do have the capacity to complete a high-speed rail link between Merced and Bakersfield. Now, I know some critics are going to say, well, that's a train to nowhere. But I think that's wrong, and I think that's offensive. The people of the Central Valley endure the worst air pollution in America and have some of the longest commutes in this state. And they have suffered too many years of neglect from policymakers, respectfully, here in Sacramento. They deserve better. And the high-speed rail project can be part of that."
But the controversy surrounding high-speed rail doesn't come close to matching the controversy of the Delta Tunnels project, California Water Fix. Proponents are saying it doesn't move more water to Southern California, it just guarantees a steady supply of water. Here in Northern California, Delta area residents and farmers are saying it's a Southern California water grab that's going to upend the Delta, destroying farmland, destroying the area's agritourism, and increasing the chances of more salinity in the water surrounding the Delta farmlands. And here's what the governor had to say about that.
"We need a fresh approach when it comes to meeting California's massive water challenges. We have a big state, diverse water needs. Cities that need clean drinking water, farms that need irrigation to keep feeding the world, fragile ecosystems that must be protected. Our water supply is becoming less reliable because of climate change, and our population's growing because of a strong economy. That means a lot of demand on an unpredictable supply. There are no easy answers, but let me be as direct about where I stand as I can be. I do not support the water fix as currently configured, meaning I do not support the Twin Tunnels. We can, however, build on the important work that's already been done. And that's why I do support a single tunnel. The status quo is not an option. We need to protect our water supply from earthquakes, from rising sea levels. We need to preserve Delta fisheries, and we need to meet the needs of cities and farms. We have got to get past these old binaries, like farmers versus environmentalists, the North versus South. Our approach can't be either or. It has to be yes and, conveyance and efficiency. and recycling projects, like the ones we're seeing in Southern California's Met Water District, expanding floodplains in the Central Valley, and groundwater recharge like farmers are already doing in Fresno County. A portfolio approach to building water infrastructure and meeting long-term demand.
Reaction to a proposed single Delta tunnel was quick. One of the biggest supporters of the Twin Tunnels project is the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California. At the conclusion of Governor Newsom's State of the State address, their general manager, Jeffrey Kightlinger, issued a statement. He said while a single tunnel project will not resolve all pumping problems in the Delta and is less flexible for dealing with climate change impacts, it's imperative that we move forward rapidly on a conveyance project. Having no Delta fix imperils all of California. Kightlinger said that the Metropolitan Water District intends to work constructively with the Newsom administration on developing a refined California water fix project that addresses the needs of cities, farms, and the environment. Meanwhile, Delta area farmers and residents are cautiously optimistic. Barbara Berrigan-Poria is with the group Restore the Delta.
We're very happy that Governor Newsom has listened to our very broad coalition, from environmentalists to farmers to fishermen and residents throughout California, to drop the Twin Tunnels project. Of course, in the Delta, you know, stand by the position that no tunnels is the best solution. But we will analyze everything that the Newsom administration puts forward, and we'll look at things with the same critical eye produced by the Department of Water Resources and evaluate what they bring forward. We're also going to advocate very strongly the next year for a no-tunnel solution that we've put forward for quite some time, but we have more to add to it.
The Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta is the largest and most unique estuary on the Pacific Coast. Its waters support the largest nursery for California fisheries, the largest Pacific Coast flyover stop for migrating waterfowl, over 500,000 acres of California prime farmland, and an urban community that's home to over 4 million people.
Now, some farmers might argue with this next statement about the new farm bill, but from one person's viewpoint,
dairy was the commodity that fared best in the farm bill.
And why?
Because it needed to.
Alan Birga with the National Milk Producers Federation telling a farm bill forum in Washington recently that dairy operators, especially small and mid-sized producers, have been facing bigger financial problems, more stress than farmers in some other ag sectors. Small and mid-sized operations in the Midwest and Northeast are going out of business at what he calls an alarming rate with a domino effect. He says when a farm goes out,
that's a kid who's not being picked up on the school bus this fall. And that is a farmer who is not going to their feed store. That is a family that had to uproot. That is a consolidation that's been going on for a generation that has been accelerating in the past 2 years.
The margin protection program in the 2014 Farm Bill was supposed to at least slow that down. It was designed to make payments to producers based partly on the difference between the price of feed and the farm price of milk, the margin. It was much like an insurance policy. Producers could buy varying levels of coverage to protect against downward swings in milk prices or upswings in feed costs. But it didn't help producers as it was expected to. Farmers said it cost too much for what it provided. Now, the new farm bill changes the name from the margin protection program to
the dairy margin coverage program
and provides for
more affordable comprehensive coverage for small producers, while at the same time giving large producers a potentially meaningful level of coverage that would be attracted to them.
To do this required lawmakers to authorize a
major increase in spending on dairy policy.
Carl Zuloff there is a longtime ag analyst at Ohio State University. He told us the new program lowers premiums producers have to pay, allows them to protect more of their production, and increases the likelihood of the program kicking in to pay producers.
And I think that was a direct response to the financial stress in the dairy industry.
But is it going to work?
You know, will costs get too high? Will stress continue? So we don't, you know, I think it's presumptuous to assume you know what the answer is going to be.
But Alan Berga with the Milk Producers Federation thinks the new program should help many dairy operators, but dairies are failing at a rapid rate, so he says the program needs to be implemented quickly. And the USDA man in charge of Farm Bill implementation, Deputy Secretary Steve Sinski, says
the dairy margin coverage program, that's a top priority.
In Washington, Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey. He takes a look at the weather ahead for the week for the country.
Looking ahead to week two, this covers the time period from February 19th through the 25th. Below normal temperatures are going to dominate the country, particularly across the northern and western United States. We will see some continuing warmth, though, across the lower southeast, particularly in Florida. And with this cold weather pattern, we are expecting quite a bit of precipitation nearly nationwide. That means more snow, especially across the upper Midwest into the Northeast. And the only area expecting to be on the dry side from the 19th through the 25th, California. That may be a welcomed break after the storms expected between now and then, and portions of neighboring states. But again, the remainder of the country, particularly the central and eastern U.S., expected to remain wet. That could also lead to some additional flooding in areas already experiencing river and lowland flooding.
The combination of storms California has had for the past week, cold storms, warm storms, has played havoc with the snowpack and played havoc with the planning at the reservoirs. Along the American River, Folsom Dam releases were increased to 15,000 cubic feet per second to make room for an increase in snowmelt. And it's a mixed bag of weather for the week ahead for much of the Sacramento Valley. AccuWeather is predicting sunny, breezy, and cool weather for Monday and Tuesday. Rain possible on Wednesday. Cloudy and partly sunny on Thursday and Friday. Showers on Saturday. Sun and some clouds on Sunday. Take your pick. Highs for the most part will be in the 50s and 60s. Overnight lows, mid-30s to low 40s. Take the KSTE Farm Hour with you wherever you go. It's available at KSTE.com or the iHeartRadio app in streaming mode, or you can download it from your favorite third-party podcast aggregator such as iTunes. The Modesto Bee reports some news that many Central Valley farmers will be pleased by. Felicia Marcus, whose push for larger river flows angered farmers and community leaders throughout the northern San Joaquin Valley, won't continue as chairwoman of the State Water Resources Control Board. Governor Gavin Newsom named Joaquin Esquivel as chairman of the powerful Water Regulatory Board. It was back in December that the Marcus-led Water Board approved a Bay Delta plan requiring 30 to 50% of unimpaired flows February through June in the Tuolumne, Stanislaus, and Merced Rivers to improve the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta to boost salmon populations. Newsom said in the first State of the State address that Esquivel would bring balance to state water policy. His appointment is considered a positive sign for voluntary settlement agreements that are less onerous for water agencies, like the Modesto and Turlock irrigation districts. Esquivel made a lot of friends during last year's negotiations. Those were testy hearings on the Bay Delta plan last fall, and Valley leaders gave credit to Esquivel for visiting communities that would be affected by the Water Board plan. The Modesto Irrigation District, Turlock Irrigation Districts, and local agencies in Stanislaus County fiercely opposed the flow requirements, saying the plan would cut water deliveries to farmers and undermine the sound management of reservoirs in drought years. And another group welcomed Joaquin Esquivel to chairmanship of the State Water Resources Board, but they're going to miss Felicia Marcus. That would be Restore the Delta. Here's that group's Barbara Berrigan-Paria.
We look forward to working with Joaquin Esquivel. He is a thoughtful board member presently. We are sure that he will do a good job in leadership as chair of the State Water Resources Control Board. We are also greatly saddened that Felicia Marcus is leaving. We've enjoyed working with her throughout the years, and we think that she brought a truly balanced and reasonable voice to issues. You know, the farmers complain a lot about what they didn't get under Ms. Marcus's leadership, but they forget we didn't get exactly what we wanted either. It's a tough job.
And another appointment announced by Governor Newsom, Laurel Firestone, co-founder of the Community Water Center, was appointed as the replacement for Felicia Marcus on the board. Marcus's term expired January 15th. Firestone's appointment is consistent with Newsom's push for clean drinking water for communities. Mike Wade of the California Farm Water Coalition said that with the change in the board, they're hopeful they'll see movement to more flexibility in meeting water supply and ecosystem needs.
Regular USDA reports were halted during the government shutdown, but the National Ag Statistics Service has been busy making sure everything is back on track.
Here at NAS, many reports were affected by the shutdown, so we've rescheduled over 35 reports, and we'll have many more coming out with future Ag Statistics Board notices.
That was Ag Statistics Board Chair Joe Parsons.
Some reports we were able to release quite quickly. We released in agricultural prices just a few days after coming back from the shutdown.
He says the data for the agricultural prices report had been collected before the shutdown, so NAS was able to get that report out quickly. Meanwhile, he discusses another priority, the crop production report that was released on February 8th.
And in that report, we'll be releasing all the information that we would have released on January 11th. We had had most of all of that data collected just before the shutdown, but we had not had the opportunity to analyze it with our statisticians and such.
One significant delay is the release of the results for the 2017 Census of Agriculture, which was originally set for this month.
In our return to operations, we knew that it was very important for us to make sure and get the market-sensitive reports out, and we know that we want to produce a great product for all of our stakeholders when it comes to the Census of Agriculture, and we have a few key steps that we need to complete and make sure that we do a thorough job so we have a great release on April 11th.
The Ag Census takes place once every 5 years.
The Census of Agriculture is the one source of data that shows the structure of agriculture and how it's changing here in the United States all the way down to the county level. And so, you know, it's used in a myriad of decisions and it has a long shelf life.
He gives a preview of some of the top issues to look out for in the 2017 Ag Census.
This release of the Census of Agriculture we're excited about for a number of reasons. We're going to have the opportunity to better illuminate new and beginning farmers and their role in U.S. agriculture. Also, we're going to have additional statistics on veterans in agriculture for the first time, so we're very excited about that. And we're also going to be able to do a better job of describing those that are involved in the decision-making in agriculture.
The Census of Agriculture is a complete count of U.S. farms and ranches and the people who operate them. Again, the release date for the 2017 Ag Census is April 11th. This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The American Farm Bureau Federation supports two Senate bills designed to give farmers and ranchers relief from the health insurance tax. The AFBF's Chad Smith has more.
When the health insurance tax goes into effect, it will add significantly to the cost of health insurance for a self-employed individual. While Congress has delayed implementation of the tax through 2019, Pat Wolf, AFBF Senior Director of Congressional Relations, warns the tax will be in full force come 2020.
That's a tax that's imposed on health insurance companies based on the premiums they collect from self-employed persons. It adds $500 to the average cost of health insurance for a self-employed person. Legislation has been introduced to delay and repeal that tax.
Senate Bill 172 would delay the hit through 2021, while Senate Bill 80 would get rid of it altogether. Wolf says the fact that the bills were introduced early gives her hope that Congress will get the issue taken care of for farmers and other self-employed Americans.
Farmers need good health insurance, and they need to be able to afford it. Anything that adds to the cost of health insurance is just bad. It makes it harder for farmers and ranchers to get good health insurance coverage, and that's why that tax needs to be repealed.
Wolf says legislation moves quicker in Congress with a large number of co-sponsors signed on. She says that's where grassroots Farm Bureau members can help.
The thing that's most helpful right now is to get those co-sponsors. Any farmer, any rancher, any citizen of the United States who cares about these issues should call their representatives and their senators and ask them to co-sponsor the bills.
Chad Smith, Washington.
A few weeks ago, two additional California ranches with egg-laying hens were confirmed positive for virulent Newcastle disease. One was a small ranch in San Bernardino County. There, the hens were euthanized. The second, though, a larger commercial facility in Riverside County. As the California Department of Agriculture and the USDA continue with their efforts to eradicate virulent Newcastle disease, Southern California bird owner Luis Aldana and CDFA veterinarian Dr. Ricardo Gaitan talk about ways to prevent the spread of the disease as well as tips for protecting your flocks.
My name is Luis Aldana, and I remember the last time we had the disease about 15 years ago, and it wiped out about 3 million plus birds. We do not want this to happen again. We want to try to stop the disease as fast as possible. That's why it's very important to let CDFA go into your property if they ask you to come into your property. Two, check out the birds that are sick, if there's any birds that are sick. Whether they're sick or not, it is better to let them come in and let them test out your bird. I want to tell my fellow rooster people, chicken people, that it is safe and very important for CDFA to come into your property, to let them come into your property and check out your birds and test your birds.
I'm Dr. Ricardo Gaitan, working with the California Department of Agriculture and the United States Department of Agriculture, trying to stop and eradicate a virulent Newcastle disease outbreak in Southern California. It's very important to remember that we're only interested in the health of your birds. It's very important that you can identify or recognize the signs of this disease. Nasal or beak discharge, neurological signs like twisting of the head and neck, droopy wings, paralyzed legs, anything, any of these signs, if you see them, please don't waste time, call the Sick Bird Hotline.
One of the best ways to keep this disease off your property is do not take any birds out of your property. Do not bring any birds out of your property. If you go to the feed store, if you go visit a friend that has other birds or anything like that, when you do, spray them before you come into your house, before you leave your house, so you don't take the disease somewhere or you don't bring the disease back. It's very important that you spray the tires of your cars, because we don't know where those tires have been as far as going into especially the pet shops or pet stores where we feed stores, where we buy our food.
One of the most important things you can do to protect your birds and prevent the spreading of this disease is biosecurity. Things that you can do is don't move animals out of your property. Don't bring more animals into your property. After working with your animals, always change your clothes, disinfect your shoes, take a shower before you visit somebody that also has birds and ask them to do the same if they're gonna visit your property.
It's very important that we spread the word to all our chicken people that we know. Our friend, somebody we might kind of know, anybody. Just let them know that disease is here and we need to try to stop it from spreading.
Talk to your friends, neighbors, colleagues, everybody that you know that own birds, and tell them everything you know about the disease and biosecurity practices. Only if we work together, we can defeat and win this battle.
For more information about virulent Newcastle disease, call the Sick Bird Hotline, 866-922-2473. That's 866-922-2473. Online, more information about virulent Newcastle disease can be found at the California Department of Food and Agriculture website, cdfa.ca.gov. Well, what goes better together than peanut butter and chocolate? Well, a lot healthier foods such as tomatoes and avocados. The Tomato Products Wellness Council, they're dedicated to promoting the health benefits of processing tomatoes, has taken on a partnership with other fruits and vegetables. At the recent California Tomato Growers Association's annual meeting in Modesto, the California Farm Bureau Federation talked with Alec Wasson about how tomatoes are teaming up with avocados.
It was about 2 years ago that the Avocado Council, Haas Avocado Board, funded a study at Ohio State University. But one of the interesting things that came out was also how the synergy, when you team it together with tomato products, how they actually are even better for you when you team the two together. We've been really running with that and really trying to help promote how you can team up tomatoes and avocados, nachos with your salsa and adding avocados on top, but also some different chili dishes that you slice avocado and put it on top of, and really trying to get people thinking about more than just one food group at a time, but how do you kind of use synergy to get the most nutrients and bang for your buck out of all that.
Processing tomato harvest in 2017 in California produced 10.4 million tons. The three leading counties for processing tomatoes in California include Fresno, Kings, and Yolo.
Hey, farmers and ranchers, been spending the last month or so trying out that new drone you received as a holiday gift? You may have noticed when taking it out for a spin some differences in flying an unmanned aerial vehicle in the winter months compared to other times of the year. Dan Swofford of Virginia Tech University says any drone operator needs to take some important winter season considerations into account, starting with
drone batteries don't get along well in cold weather.
As a cold battery in a drone will limit flying time, no matter how many times the battery is recharged. So,
make sure that battery is warmed up before you put it into your drone. It's also good to keep that drone up. Leave them in the house, keep them warm. When you go outside, take that battery, stick it in your pocket. You might use hand warmers. You might put it down in like a lunch cooler to keep it warm before you get ready to fly.
He adds keeping the drone in a vehicle from home to flight area to keep it and the battery warm is a great idea. Not so great is keeping the drone in the vehicle at all times, especially during the winter cold. Swofford says flying a drone is different in winter as well. Take 30 seconds to warm up the UAV on the ground before flying.
And then when you get ready to take off, do not use the automatic takeoff function that's found on many of these drones. It's really going to zap that battery strength if you do. Use your manual throttle, heat it up, move it up slowly.
As quick increase of the throttle will reduce battery power. A few minutes of hovering before full flight is an additional means to warm up the drone. Now in flight,
legally, you can only fly that drone 400 feet above the ground. If you have 400 feet of altitude, you have to have 500 feet between you and the cloud. So you got to have 900 feet separating you and the nearest cloud. Never fly into a cloud, especially in the wintertime, because you're going to get ice buildup.
Which will require cleanup of ice and freezing rain off the drone if a higher than recommended altitude is reached during flight.
Another thing, never fly in a snowstorm, never fly in a rainstorm. Anytime your drone gets wet, it's going to damage the electronics. Hopefully these tips will allow you to get longer flight times and enjoy using that drone in the wintertime to check on your stock and other things around the farm.
Swofford offers an additional tip. Keep a tissue or cleaning cloth with you to wipe off that fog and condensation that accumulates on drone sensors and camera lenses when a drone is transferred from warm to cold conditions. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Once again, tests have showed that the vast majority of fresh produce collected by the California Department of Pesticide Regulation met national pesticide residue standards. During the 2017 survey, DPR found that 96% of all samples had no detectable pesticide residues or were below levels that are established by the U.S. EPA. The 2017 report is based on year-round collection of over 3,000 samples of produce from 28 different countries, including those labeled as organic. DPR scientists sampled produce from various grocery stores, farmers' markets, food distribution centers, and other outlets throughout California. The produce is tested for more than 400 types of pesticides. And since more than a third of the country's fruits and vegetables are grown right here in California, there was good news about the produce grown here. Of all the samples tested by the DPR, 25% came from California. 95% of those samples had no residues on them and were within the legal levels. As far as illegal pesticide residues that were found, among those that tested positive were from elsewhere, like prickly pear and cactus pads from Mexico, as well as longan fruit from Vietnam and lychees from China. When illegal residues are found, the Department of Pesticide Regulation immediately works to remove the illegal produce to prevent it from reaching consumers, and the department also attempts to trace it back to its source. DPR then verifies that the produce is either destroyed or returned to the country of origin.
Here is a very famous quote from former President George H.W. Bush.
I want a kinder and gentler nation.
And some are saying this new farm bill is kinder and gentler to farmers because it appears that in crafting the new farm bill in Congress,
the committee's put farmers first, partisan politics second.
Which economist Dr. Barry Flinchbaugh with Kansas State University says is
almost unheard of in today's congressional operation.
Flitchbaugh told a Farm Bill forum in Washington the other day most of the changes in the new Farm Bill do put farmers first. For example, in the 2014 bill, payments for some of the USDA safety net programs, including the then-new Agricultural Risk Coverage Program in particular, were to be based partly on the five-year average county-level crop yields and reported current yields, data for those yields coming from various sources depending on the county. But when first payment checks came out, farmer complaints poured in. Tim Erbely, a North Dakota corn grower in one county, has his fields less than a mile from an adjacent county, Stutzman County.
And I'm literally 1 mile away from the Stutzman County line, and producers in Stutzman County, as I understand, got $61 an acre.
Tim got zero, no payments. These disparities continued, and again, different counties were getting their yield data from different sources. But lawmakers listened to farmers, and under this new Farm Bill, USDA will use one source, crop insurance data.
Which should bring more consistency across county lines.
Another example of being farmer-friendly, under the 2014 Farm Bill, farmers would have to choose which of the two major safety net programs they wanted to use, and they would be stuck with it for the 5 years of the bill. Somehow having to forecast the market 5 years ahead. But in the new bill,
they have a 2-year decision at first and then an annual decision.
And one analyst told me,
that's just a major change, Gary, in the philosophy and the way we implement crop programs.
Longtime Ohio State University analyst Carl Zuloff.
It will mean that producers will have to do a lot more thinking about what programs they want to go in on a year-by-year basis. And it's not a given for most crops that you would necessarily go in the same program from year to year.
Zuloff says it gives farmers more flexibility to meet changing market conditions, and it's one of the changes that economist Barry Flinchbaugh says makes this new Farm Bill a kinder, gentler bill, or at least a little more
farmer-friendly.
In Washington, Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Farmers, ranchers, and residents of Placer County can take advantage of a program that can help you reduce green waste as well as maintain defensible space to reduce the risk of wildfire. It's called the Placer County Chipper Program, and it's offered by the Placer County Resource Conservation District. What's it all about? The executive director, Elisa Noble, explains.
The Chipper Program costs $40 an hour, regardless of if it's one person or 10 people, so it's much more cost-effective to work with your neighbors, have a community work day, and get a really large pile before you go ahead and call the chipper service. Requesting a chipper service is very simple. You first start with getting all of your woody material into a big pile and make sure that it's right next to the road or somewhere easily accessible for the truck and chipper to get to it. Then you make the phone call and leave the message with your address and any pertinent information. And then within a week or two, the chipper crew will show up, chip that material, and leave you a nice pile of mulch. You don't have to be home unless there's a locked gate or something of that nature, then just be sure and say that on the message. And once the pile is complete, they will leave you a little invoice for the $40 an hour, and you're all done.
For more information, call the Placer Chipper Program at 530-889-0111, extension 3. Recently, the California Department of Pesticide Regulation honored an organization for its achievements to reduce soil fumigants in order to reduce human health and environmental risks. It's a rather unique replacement for fumigants. It's called biosolarization. And we're talking to Jim Stapleton. He's with the Integrated Pest Management Team at the Kearney Ag Center. Jim, what exactly is biosolarization?
Biosolarization is the technique of combining soil solarization, which most people are familiar with now, with various types of organic residues, organic material. There are a lot of different possibilities for these combinations. By combining solarization with the organic material in moist soil, the organic material breaks down and releases on a temporary basis some naturally occurring biotoxicants that increase the activity of solarization.
Is this solarization done in the summertime with clear plastic?
Yes, it is. That is one of the main reasons that we've been working on biosolarization. Solarization to work optimally needs to be done during periods of high air temperature. For that reason, most of the commercial ag solarization in California is being done down in the Imperial Valley, where it's too hot to grow crops during the summer, so solarization is used. And then they grow their fresh vegetable crops during the winter time. So it works out perfectly. In other parts of the state, such as here in the Central Valley, solarization does need to be done during the summertime for it to work best.
Talk a little bit about what you're using in addition to the clear plastic, the compost and the leftover, I guess it's seeds and skins of grapes and tomatoes.
That's right. There are a lot of different possibilities for using various types of organic material, and we're doing quite a bit of testing on a variety of these materials. One of the real advantages of this technique is that we can use the leftover waste that otherwise would probably have some lesser value or even have to be landfilled in order to get rid of them. But by using them in biosolarization, we actually have an economic use for them.
I would imagine that with that high heat, the combination with those leftover food parts would ferment some sort of acid, and I guess that's harmful to pests but not to people?
Yes, organic acids are a fermentation breakdown product that is part of virtually all organic materials that are subjected to a fermentation process. Solarization does not necessarily need a totally anaerobic or without oxygen environment to function, but when these organic materials do break down, they do ferment and produce organic acids, as well as quite a few other different types of chemical products, which are toxic to a lot of the soil pests.
I would think that in order to transfer a lot of those acids deeper into the soil, that soil needs to be thoroughly moistened first before the clear plastic is laid on it.
That's right. It's not biosolarization and techniques like it, and there are techniques that are similar, such as what's known as ASD, anaerobic soil disinfestation, which is a very similar process, which is actually a spin-off of biosolarization. They work best with a very wet soil profile, because unlike soil fumigant chemicals, which volatilize and become gases once they enter the soil, a lot of the products that are produced during biosolarization and ASD remain in the liquid phase. So you really need to have contact of the breaking of the decomposing organic materials with the pest organism.
I imagine there's a lot of farmers thinking right now, well, that sounds great. I hope it can get rid of my field bindweed. What has been the most successful application of biosolarization against weeds or other pests?
Biosolarization and solarization are general biocides. There are a few organisms which are more resistant to that treatment. And those organisms tend to be those that are also resistant to some of the chemical fumigants. So rather than saying which pests we've had the most success with, it might be better to just give a short list of the problematic organisms. And some of those include nutgrass, particularly purple nutsedge. That tends to be a little bit resistant, and the resting structures in the soil of that organism tend to be very large structures that are more difficult for the chemicals and the solar heating to reach. In general, solarization does a very good job in cleaning up most weed problems, most nematode problems, most fungal disease problems. it doesn't really discriminate among the pest groups per se.
Are there limits afterwards to what you can do with the soil after biosolarization? For example, can you till the soil, or would that just bring up more weed seeds?
Biosolarization is designed to work better than solarization by itself, but most commercial users do not till following treatment. So the solarization or biosolarization treatment are done on preformed beds.
Well, the cost of fumigation has been growing due to increasing regulations and more restrictions in order to protect agricultural workers and surrounding communities, especially schools. So all this research into biosolarization can certainly be a big benefit to farmers who find it very necessary for some sort of fumigant. For instance, I would think the berry industry would be very interested in this.
A lot of the work that's being done on anaerobic soil disinfestation, which is basically biosolarization with a minimum of solar heating, is being done in the coastal areas where it doesn't get as hot as it does here in the Central Valley or down in the desert valleys.
What's the next step for biosolarization?
The next step is to develop grower guidelines for the use of biosolarization. Again, there are some challenges because different soils with different pests, different climates react in different ways. And so that's why we demonstrate for the growers. We try to show them how we can do things to optimally knock out these soil pests. But in the end, it's a seat of the pants learning curve, and they need to test things out for themselves and find out what works best for them.
It's ongoing research in alternatives to soil fumigants being conducted by the biosolarization team. It's a team of scientists from the UC Davis Department of Biological and Agricultural Engineering, the UC Kearney Ag Research Center, and the UC Cooperative Extension, and they were recently honored with an Integrated Pest Management Achievement Award from the Department of Pesticide Regulation here in California for their research and their findings. Jim Stapleton, thanks for a few minutes of your time telling us more about biosolarization.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to the KSTE Farm Hour, heard every Sunday from noon until 1 p.m. Pacific Time, and available anytime as a podcast. Download it at KSTE.com.